This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
Shortwave listening. To many, the final frontier. These are the voyages of PCJ Radio's Media Network Plus. Its continuing mission to track down strange new signals and to seek out new stations and radio personalities and to boldly go where many men have gone before.
Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to the July 27th edition of Media Network Plus, the monthly version of the program. It's very nice to have you with us. Today, we're going to be bringing you a documentary that we ran before, and we're doing it because many of you want to hear it again. It's called Wartime Deception, so stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, tickling the airwaves. Before we continue with today's program, I should mention that, yes, I am a Star Trek fan. You're listening, of course, to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This month on the monthly edition of the program, which is heard on WRMI on 9,955 kilohertz, as well as on a number of partner stations around the world, we're going to be bringing to you a series of two documentaries produced by Jonathan Marks called Wartime Deception. Now, this is a documentary that we ran before, but many of you enjoyed it so much that you wanted to hear it again. So, you requested, and we played it. We now bring you part one.
If you'd been listening to a shortwave radio here in Europe between 1939 and 45, the bands would have sounded very different back then. International radio listening was a risky business. In many parts of Nazi-occupied Europe, even the possession of a radio could earn you the death penalty. Despite that threat, people were listening more than ever, undercover in many cases. Those in the armed forces had access to good receivers, and naturally a lot of news travelled by word of mouth. Before we illustrate some of the resistance radio that could be heard, let's put the shortwave medium into context. With no satellites in existence, communications over any distance, be it civil or military, went by shortwave radio. Because Morse code could penetrate the static better than the human voice, most secret agents from both sides used Morse code to communicate. It was also less conspicuous to be tapping away than shouting into a microphone when you might be overheard. But there were plenty of voices on the bands too. News from Canada being relayed to the troops in Europe.
The farmers of Canada are arming themselves this summer against their old enemies, black flies in Saskatchewan, warble flies in Manitoba, and grasshoppers in British Columbia.
Allied military units used to issue official communiques for the press agencies, Allied broadcasting stations, and anyone else who was listening, including the enemy. News from the Southwest Pacific Area headquarters, for instance.
GHQ, Southwest Pacific Area, communique number 93.
Most people didn't need to search the dial for weak military communiques. There were, of course, the regular broadcasting stations.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snagg.
And on the other side of the political spectrum, there was Radio Tokyo with its English service.
Once again, our time is up, and your MC of the Hinomaru Hour must say, Oyasumi Nasai. We hope you have enjoyed our Christmas programs and that they have served in some small way to let you know how your boys are living as prisoners of war in far-off Japan. We invite you to be with us again at this time tomorrow evening. This is John C. wishing you all a very Merry Christmas from the Hinomaru Hour. Good night, all. You are listening to Radio Tokyo.
Listeners in Britain were treated to the rather menacing voice of William Joyce, broadcasting from Berlin.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender ambush, Station Bremen and Station DXB on the 31-meter band.
The studios may have been in Berlin, but many of those nightly Nazi broadcasts came from mobile transmitters. Roy Neal was the European Programme Director for the American Forces Network in Frankfurt just after the war. He recalls how the Germans did it.
Well, as a matter of fact, one of the most ingenious devices that the Nazis dreamed up was their system of international broadcasting to prevent their transmitters from being bombed out. As you know, a radio station is an automatic target because, electronically speaking, it can be found so easily. We use them, as a matter of fact, to vector our aircraft from one point to another. For the most part, Nazi propaganda stemmed from Berlin. It was easily controllable from there. And what they did was feed from their Berlin studios through the landlines, broadcast circuits, incidentally. Class A circuits is what we would have called them in the broadcast business. They'd feed that down the line, and then the transmitters were moved around like chessmen on a chessboard.
Those special broadband telephone lines to carry the studio sound from Berlin to the mobile transmitters were well planned before the war. They followed the major motorway routes. At every few kilometres, there was a concrete box where engineers could plug in.
Then they put in 100,000-watt transmitters truck-mounted, with huge trailers, even power supplies in the rear. They would then run these transmitters up to the nearest point of contact, plug in, go on the air, stay on the air for 2, maybe 3 hours, unplug, and be on to another destination, and that way the Allies couldn't bomb out the transmitters.
But what about the antennas?
The antennas came right with the trucks. They were beautiful antennas that could be cranked up from a fixed position. You still see that kind of antenna today. The only thing is, today when you see that sort of antenna being reeled out of a truck, you see a microwave dish up on top of it, or a dish that can be pointed at the nearest satellite.
But, and the powers were really as much as 100 kilowatts.
That was practically their standard broadcast power, 100,000 watts.
These mobile transmitters were handy for other, more covert purposes. In December 1939, the Germans created a shortwave clandestine station in the French language, the Awakening of Peace.
Vous écoutez le réveil de la paix. Attention la France. Restez à l'écoute.
The station wasn't peaceful at all. It pretended to come from near Paris, though probably it was broadcast from transmitters in Poland. It told listeners that German Jews who'd escaped from Nazi Germany to France were really a network of spies and should be mistrusted. It spread rumours that the French government was about to make a run for it, some 4 months before they really did leave Paris. In April 1940, a second French station began, taking the name of the French communist newspaper of the day.
Radio Humanité vous parle. La voix d'une France socialiste.
It tried to win support for the Germans amongst the socialist circles, but its acid tone and boring style wasn't very effective. In February 1940, as well as English broadcasts by William Joyce announcing as coming from Berlin, Dr. Goebbels started the first of several clandestine voices from Germany aimed towards Britain.
Attention! This is the new British broadcasting station.
That station later became Workers' Challenge. Supposedly coming from somewhere in the British Midlands, it denounced Churchill's leadership and used obscene language to attack capitalism in general. But it had a curious opening tune for a station supposedly coming from the Midlands. It was really a Scottish air.
On the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond.
Just before the war started, Englishman Harold Robin had been working as an engineer in Liechtenstein. He was busy with a project to start high-power commercial radio in that tiny European country, wedged between Switzerland and Austria. It should have become another Radio Luxembourg, but with war clouds looming, Robin was advised to get back to England. By 1940, he'd become involved with running short clandestine broadcasts into occupied France, now overrun by the Germans. The first morale booster to the French resistance was rather primitive.
The very first one was a French broadcast from a communications station in Gloucestershire in a place called North Cerny. And we did the first broadcast to France from a caravan using a 5-kilowatt transmitter. It soon became obvious that this was really a drop in the ocean, and we were told to expand.
In the English county of Buckinghamshire, north of London, they found the ideal site for two 7.5-kilowatt transmitters at a place called Gorcott. Another transmitter site with identical equipment went up in the nearby village of Pottsgrove.
The studio was a very fine country house in Buckinghamshire called Wavendon Towers, and this was taken over by requisition. The idea was to take the people from the countries taken by Germany into a secure accommodation in around Wavendon. Mostly these were old houses, rectories and so on. They must have had about 15 of these houses. And a crew of, for example, the French would go into one of these houses and would live there and be guarded, literally guarded, by a keeper who was in charge of them from both the security and also the program material.
What were they worried about? I mean, I can understand them wanting to guard the, let's say, the Germans and the Italians, but why guard the French?
Well, that was a special reason for the fact that there were more than one French program, and these had to be kept very separate because one group did not know that the other was operating. And by the end of the operation, there were as many as 8 French programs. We got up to F8. We numbered them by simple F1, 2, 3. We got to F8, and they were very antagonistic to the other groups. So these were both guarded and securely scripted, well away from any other groups. Now this happened from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. The group would come in, make its program, be signed for by the keeper, and then the disc, because this was all on 16-inch vinyl discs, were then carried to the broadcasting station by car and broadcast appropriate number of times. Sometimes it was every hour, sometimes it was every other hour, and some of them were even every half hour.
Keeping the rival French groups apart was quite a problem, but each was aimed at a different sector of French society. There was Workers' Radio, run by a spokesman of the French trade unions.
Ici, Radio Travail.
Another was called Radio Inconnu, or Radio Unknown.
Radio Inconnu!
Radio Inconnu!
Radio Inconnu!
Radio Inconnu!
Radio Inconnu!
That station pretended to operate from the suburbs of Paris and advocated all types of passive resistance. Then there was the voice of the Gaullist movement, directly attacking the Vichy government.
Ici, Radio Gaulle.
And then a station that used a real French priest. He conducted Catholic Mass on the air, and his sermons were critical of the way the Nazis treated religion.
Ici la France catholique. Ici la France catholique. Mes bien chers frères, cette émission sera consacrée uniquement à la prière.
Although in its infant stage, the secret activity was starting to generate unwanted activity from within other parts of the British government. A presentation disc was made for a very special visit to the clandestine radio headquarters. On it, one of those involved in the organisation, Colonel Gambier Parry, explains their predicament.
It is much easier to disguise the transmissions from the enemy than from inquisitive officialdom in this country. Some months ago, a certain department set about locating our first station. Their first conclusion was somewhere in India. That seemed to be the wrong end of the stick. So Le Havre became the suspect area. The final compromise is recorded by the laconic entry in an official file. Illicit enemy broadcasting station located in Syria.
The four shortwave transmitters in Buckinghamshire put out other clandestine voices. Initially, there were two for Italy. There was Radio Italy.
Attenzione, attenzione. Parla Radio Italia.
And then Radio Liberty, which revealed curious intimate details of Mussolini's private life.
Attenzione, attenzione. Qui parla Radio Libertà.
In the space of 1 year, more than 20 of these freedom voices were conjured up. Some of the Italian voices were short-lived because the workers and farmers that the stations tried to reach quite obviously didn't have shortwave radios. The Dutch language station was also short-lived because the Dutch government in exile in London was doing enough morale-boosting back in the Netherlands thanks to airtime they had on the BBC under the name Radio Oranje or Radio Orange. For southeastern Europe, there were more successful short broadcasts aimed at Yugoslavia, Bulgaria and Romania. The Slavic presenter started his talk by whistling a traditional folk song, whose refrain went, "Out with them, out with them."
Ovdje slobodna hrvatska radio postaja Zrinski. Ovdje slobodna hrvatska radio postaja Zrinski.
Engineer Harold Robbins spent several hours in the basement of Waverden Towers until they put enough echo on the Bulgarian voice to give it a ghostly feeling. There was a station aimed at Austria too, Radio Red Vienna. Red being a reference to its socialist character.
Wir österreichische Sozialisten begrüßen diesen Schritt unserer russischen und englischen Genossen. Die Spaltung der internationalen Arbeiterbewegung, insbesondere die Spaltung der deutschen Arbeiter in Sozialdemokraten und Kommunisten, hat viel zur Niederlage der Arbeiter im Kampf gegen den Hitlerfaschismus beigetragen.
And of course, there was a station directed towards Germany. On November the 10th, 1940, its clock tuning signal first appeared on shortwave.
Achtung, Achtung! Hier ist der Sender der Europäischen Revolution. Wir sprechen für alle, die zum Schweigen verdammt sind.
Overall, those in charge of the operation were quite pleased.
In our own engineering headquarters, we are unashamedly christened the UBCU, the letters UBCU, or Ungentlemanly Broadcasting Corporation Unlimited.
In 1941, the former Berlin correspondent of the English newspaper The Daily Express joined the secret radio operations centre in Buckinghamshire. Sefton Delmer had been born in the German capital of Australian parents and knew the Third Reich well.
Delmer came in quite a bit later and immediately saw that the way it was going was quite unsatisfactory and was unprofessional, as he used to say. Now, his idea was that these broadcasts should not just be freedom stations, they should be something a bit more. And he coined the phrase black broadcasting. That is to make them in every way appear to be coming from within the country, in this case, Germany.
One of the wartime broadcasters behind the microphone was Peter Weichmann.
The general format, the introduction, usually a march, German march, of course. The way in which the news was presented, I mean, the enemy, of course, were always the Allies, and so on. Our troops were the German troops, and so on. That's a sort of superficial way in which one did it, but also to some extent by the use of what we used to call cover items, in other words, straight German news taken from the German news agency, which we received simultaneously through a Hellschreiber, a technical device for transmitting news agency stuff. received this at the same time as the German press and the German radio, so we could use that as cover, as we called it. And embedded in this cover were these subversive items.
In order to sound authentic, it was vital that the most up-to-date information was at hand. Local gossip was collected from captured prisoners of war.
They were brought in, as they were captured, into camps in different parts of the country. And there were scouts, which were organised by Dilma, to spot anybody who was likely to have information which would be useful to the programme. I don't ever remember him saying that anybody was uncooperative in this. The Germans, having been captured, put into a fairly comfortable camp, were very cooperative. And he got a massive information of high intelligence value, for example, of ships which had been captured, information about the captain, what was going on in the ports.
By April 1941, Dilma created a new station. He called it Gustav Siegfried Eins, or GS1. A corporal, Peter Seckelmann, born in Berlin, was in London at the outbreak of war. He sided with the British, but being an enemy alien, found himself on bomb disposal duty at first. He was spotted as excellent material for a German clandestine radio station. He would play the part of the chief, a gruff, foul-mouthed military man who played a double game. A recording still exists of Sefton Dilma explaining the philosophy behind the station.
This chef has a political platform. He wants Germany to win the war, and he's not satisfied with the way things are going. He says Germany can't fight the Bolsheviks in Russia with real effect while Bolsheviks rule at home. And he calls everyone a Bolshevik whom he doesn't like. For instance, the chef stimulates black market trading, not by saying that black markets are a good thing. On the contrary, he protests against black markets, but he points out that the people selling on the black markets are making fortunes, and that people buying there are getting the things which they can't get elsewhere. The great thing about this chef is that he really does sound like a 1941 German. His language is based on a study of the war jargon talked by German prisoners of war. Secret Service reports, censorship intercepts, prisoner reports, German newspapers, RAF reconnaissance photographs, and plenty of imagination supply him with that intimate knowledge of Germany which only a person living on the spot can have. Even the call sign with which the chef begins his broadcasts cocks a snook at the party. The Nazi broadcasts of the Deutschlandsender have taken the first phrase of the Potsdam Garrison Church Carillon. The chef calls his listeners from a cracked piano with the second phrase, which the Deutschlandsender has omitted to play, and thereby symbolizes musically what he does to German propaganda, carrying Nazi ideology just one phrase further into the ridiculous, where it's harmful to Germany. Here is the chef's call. The voice of the announcer. It's a harsh Prussian voice.
Achtung, Achtung, hier Gustav Siegfried Eins.
Part one of Wartime Deception from Jonathan Marks, a series of two programs that he produced for Radio Nederland when he was doing Media Network. And in a few moments, we will bring you part two. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. If you want to send us a verification card to receive our eQSL, the address is very simple. It's pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. That's pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. You can also write us via snail mail to the following address: PCJ Radio International, attention, Media Network Plus, 8th floor, number 47, Lane 31, Sanmin Road, Section 1, New Taipei City, Banqiao, 22070ROCL. Say that again. PCJ Radio International, attention, Media Network Plus, 8th floor, number 47, Lane 31, Sanmin Road, Section 1, New Taipei City, Banqiao, Taiwan 22070.
You can hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question, but there's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Catch us Wednesdays at 4 p.m. on New Zealand's World FM.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 idents and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues. And a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia, in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxer.ca. Good listening, everyone.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdeen Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4, 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
And if you want more information about the BDXC, send us an email, mnp@pcjmedia.com, and we will forward that contact information to you. Well, it's now time to bring you part two of Wartime Deception, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Last time, we examined some of the secret voices on the air in Europe during the Second World War. There were early German attempts to prepare for the Nazi invasion of France. And then a whole string of resistance voices broadcast from 4 7.5 kilowatt transmitters in Britain. One of the most important operations from this site was run by newspaper journalist and black propaganda specialist Sefton Delmer. Called Gustav Siegfried Eins, this clandestine German voice pretended to be a disgruntled military man broadcasting from somewhere outside Berlin. Clearly, though, as Germany was so close to Britain, medium-wave broadcasting would be more effective than shortwave. Engineer Harold Robin went to the United States to buy a high-powered medium-wave transmitter. The underground complex to house the equipment, nicknamed Aspidistra after the wartime song, was in southern England at a place called Crowborough.
Now, question is, why Crowborough? Well, when I started talking around Whitehall about putting in 500 kilowatt or 600 kilowatts, everybody threw their hands up in horror. Because in those days, people like the post office took delight in stopping anything happening at all. The Home Office said, oh, you can't go there because that will interfere with radio for police and so on. The Navy said, no, you can't. You'll spoil the radio in the channel if you go too near Dover, which is where we wanted to go. And the Air Force said, well, you mustn't come near any of our airfields. So I took a map to Whitehall, and we had all these signals officers in, and they all said, well, we couldn't go. And there was a place left in the middle of Ashdown Forest called Crowborough where nobody cared. So we put it up there, and it turned out to be a good site. It was high. It's 600 feet above sea level with a clear line of sight to the sea. You can see the sea on a nice day. And we started work there. Then, of course, bombing started, and everyone said, oh, you can't put a transmitter, so many eggs in one basket. You must proof it against bombing. So the design was changed, and we decided to bury it, and it was buried underground in a very large concrete building, which we dug down 50 feet down, and with a concrete slab on the top of 4 foot thick, reinforced concrete, and all the earth piled back on the top. So it was a pretty secure job.
At the end of 1942, Aspidistra was ready for testing.
First transmission was on November the 9th, 1942. And this was the occasion of the landings in North Africa. And here we had a special program to broadcast, which was a message from Roosevelt to the French saying, look, we're joining and we're landing here. Please don't shoot. So this message was recorded in the Oval Office in the White House on a 6-inch vinyl disc by Roosevelt's nephew, who was said to be a dabster at recording. This disc was packed up and sent by special airplane all the way to us at Wavendon Towers, and we copied it onto the big discs, and we were to broadcast it at a certain time on that November the 9th, which we did. And then the other discs were later handed to the BBC so that they could follow it up with their program. But we were the first to do this. So that was the first operation. And, of course, everybody said, no, it's much too far away. You'll never reach North Africa with Aspidistra. Well, it actually was, and it was very well heard. Fortunately, on a low frequency, 620, which was nice and low, so the propagation was good.
Le débarquement du corps expéditionnaire américain en Afrique française du Nord, constitue le premier pas vers la libération de la France.
By the middle of 1943, the British decided to switch tactics in their clandestine broadcasts to Germany. Gustav Siegfried Eins had always pretended to broadcast from inside the Third Reich. The English decided to dramatically kill him off one night. They recorded a scene where Gestapo agents supposedly raided the clandestine sender. Some documents say GS1 was actually killed twice. The 10-minute drama was accidentally repeated. The new operation to replace it was originally called Shortwave Transmitter Atlantic. The listener was meant to believe that it was for the German army and navy operating from somewhere in Nazi-occupied Europe. In fact, it came from a 100-kilowatt shortwave transmitter in Crowborough, Sussex.
Deutscher Kurzwellensender Atlantik.
With the 400-kilowatt medium-wave Aspidistra transmitter in Crowborough now on the air, soldier transmitter Calais was created, running in parallel to the shortwave Atlantic service. New, specially designed studios had been built too in the grounds of Woburn Abbey at a place called Milton Bryant, back up in Buckinghamshire. Programmes were fed down a line to Crowborough from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. right through each night, but not without jamming from German transmitters.
Some days, when we were very active, we would change frequencies 6 times in a day. You see, the Germans, when they heard this transmitter, started to jam immediately. They took their own transmitters off their program and put it onto ours as jammers. And this was quite effective. I mean, there was very strong jamming all over Germany when it started. So it was necessary to move. And we had a monitoring station up where the studio are, up at Milton Bryant. And we had, I think there were about six girls there working, monitoring all the time, monitoring the German stations, and to find out where there were holes in the network and where there was nobody broadcasting, and also to warn us when the jamming was coming up. So we were fairly well armed with information about this, and we used to take the decision that we must change the frequency, and then it'd all pile up on us again, they would change again, and so on. Their transmitters, of course, weren't made for changing frequency quickly, and it was therefore a bit of a job for them.
Soldatenzender Calais gave excellent coverage right across the English Channel and into northern France. And unlike the other Freedom stations, which were still making short broadcasts several times a night, Soldatenzender was continuous. George Jacobs was in Europe at that time and recalls how well it was received.
Not only were Hitler speeches relayed, changed occasionally, very occasionally, not only were the daily war reports relayed, perhaps a word or two changed or a number or two changed occasionally, but the programs had to be entertaining as well, and quite often some of the entertaining broadcasts on the German radio were relayed just as they were broadcast on German stations, and quite often additional programs were added. I guess to just raise that question, and one of the outstanding programs were the weekly series by Glenn Miller for Deutsche Soldaten. And, of course, one could very well raise the question, how come listeners in Germany didn't realize that Glenn Miller, who they knew as a famous American band leader, was playing popular tunes in German and speaking German, not very good German, but German, and was never announced as a prisoner of war? Where were these programs coming from? But I think that was part of the effort of Grey Radio, was to raise these sort of questions. And then this type of answers that you get were, well, the records were smuggled out of Britain, or maybe he was doing it and being paid for it. I hear today from German friends of mine all kinds of answers to that question.
Mondscheinserenade heißt diese romantische Melodie. Und denen, die heute zum ersten Mal zuhören, möchte ich kurz wiederholen, dass dies die Sendezeichenmusik Major Glenn Millers ist. Es ist seine eigene Komposition. Deutsche Soldaten, vor das Mikrofon tritt jetzt persönlich Major Glenn Miller.
How do you do, Ilse? Here we are again for our short rendezvous, and I wish to thank you for the nice things you said about the members of our orchestra. I'd like to add that you find all nationalities among them. There are even quite a number of boys whose parents came from Germany, Russia, Italy, and many other countries.
Ach, das war so schön.
Don't get sentimental, Ilse. That's bad for your heart. I mean, das ist nicht gut für das Herz.
Sie haben recht, Herr Major. Gönnen wir meinem Herzen und Ihren tüchtigen Musikern eine kleine Pause und übergeben wir das Mikrofon unserem Berichterstatter.
Ilse, we now call on Sergeant Ray McKinley, who has more rhythm than a cat on a hot brick.
Today, even when I mention this to Americans, they find it hard to believe in. Some of the tapes that you may have heard and that I have, where Glenn Miller's orchestra and Glenn Miller himself is speaking German and singing in German, are classics. It's the only place they exist, because unfortunately Glenn Miller was a victim of the war himself and died in an airplane crash just about a year after the programs began on Soldatenzender Calais.
The success of the high-power medium-wave transmitter caused heated debate within the British government. The BBC was furious that it hadn't been given the chance to get airtime on Aspidistra. But when too many British bombers were being shot down by German fighter aircraft, the Air Ministry went to see Winston.
Churchill discussed this with the Chiefs of Staff and said, well, I don't want to lose this programme, but for short times, yes, they can have it. So we started an operation which we then called Dartboard at the time. The Germans were having trouble controlling their fighters by shortwave and ultra-shortwave because the RAF were carrying their own jammers with them. The Germans decided that since they couldn't do that to control the fighters, they controlled them on medium waves. And they turned some of the medium wave transmitters into control transmitters against the bombers. This is where we came in. People in the Air Ministry decided the best thing to do would be to jam that. So we were asked to do what we could on that. Well, what happened was that the Air Force monitored very carefully and gave us information on a special telephone line which we had put in, where they were going and what frequencies they thought that the Germans would be using to control. And we would put up a program which consisted of yesterday's monitoring of what the Germans were doing. The program was monitored at Kingsdown in Kent and passed to us on a line, and we put it onto the transmitter, and of course it was giving instructions to the fighters to go where they went yesterday.
Well, imagine getting this kind of sound in the headphones.
And this worked very well indeed, apparently. Bomber Command told the signals people that this was very effective and credited us with saving 20 and 30 bombers a night.
But weren't you the target of bombing? Because obviously the Germans must have realised that this was a medium wave operation and coming from Sussex.
Interesting point, but no, we were never attacked directly by bombs except by one aeroplane that dropped a lot of incendiary bombs, which we think were simply unloaded because they all fell about a mile away from the station, I mean dozens of them. No, we were never attacked except when it came much later to the doodlebugs, to the V1 flying bombs. And they didn't attack us, but they flew so close to the ground because Crowborough was the highest point between the sending point and London that they skimmed over the hill very close. And on one ghastly occasion, when a doodlebug flew right under the guise of the mast and hit nothing, went straight through without touching anything, everybody ducked, put their fingers in their ears. But it was just a near miss.
Perhaps the most ingenious operation by Aspidistra was how it helped to cause confusion in Germany during an Allied air raid. Unlike Britain, which had synchronised several broadcast transmitters onto one frequency, the German broadcasting network consisted of several regional transmitting stations. Tuning up the dial in northwest Europe, you could find the broadcasts from Berlin on several channels, one from a transmitter in Cologne, and then a little further up the band was the transmitter in Hamburg carrying the same programme. Because a radio transmitter can be used as a navigational aid, it wasn't surprising that when Allied bombers got within 50 miles of a German broadcast transmitter, it was taken off the air. The British decided to take advantage of the dead air to put out confusing messages. Let's take an example. The British Air Ministry would advise the secret broadcasting complex in Milton Bryant, north of London, that the target that night was Hamburg. Two radios at Milton Bryant were then set up to monitor two different regional German transmitters, one broadcasting from Cologne, let's say, and the other coming from Hamburg. A beat frequency oscillator on the radio tuned to Hamburg's channel was then switched in, giving a steady tone.
Ein im Atlantik operierender deutscher Flottenverband unter Führung des Flottenchefs.
Two telephone lines from the radios at Milton Bryant fed the output to the Aspidistra transmitter site at Crowborough. The giant medium-wave transmitter was tuned to Hamburg's frequency, but put into an automatic standby mode. When the Hamburg transmitter went off the air because of the Allied bombers, the tone generated by the Milton Bryant radio stopped. There was a 5-millisecond click, and Aspidistra came on the air instead of Hamburg, with the German programme being picked up by the British from Cologne. Now that people in northern Germany thought they were still listening to the Hamburg transmitter, the propagandists could make a few special announcements.
So, with that information and that transmitter, Delmer's boys would go ahead carrying on with announcements exactly in the same way, because they trained for this, and they were all German-speaking, of course. They would then give instructions to the public, say that everybody should move to so-and-so, and that people should not do this, should not do that, and so on. Quite a lot of instructions. And then after perhaps 5 minutes, no more, we would go off the air completely, and then the bombers would come. And, of course, people in Hamburg at that time would be convinced that they were given proper and authoritative instructions. So we played this trick many times over, I suppose about 10 times altogether, and it was considered to be most effective.
Meanwhile, with the liberation of Calais, Soldatensender changed its name to Soldier Transmitter West. The music and doctored news continued.
Achtung, Kameraden des Heeres im Westen und in Norwegen. Der Soldatensender West, angeschlossen der deutsche Kurzwellensender Atlantik, bringt jetzt seinen Kameradschaftsdienst für die Angehörigen des Heeres im Westen und in Norwegen.
Mind you, German Nazi propaganda wasn't standing still. Even though the up-tempo jazz music, played by Soldatensender, was banned by the official German radio, collaborators in northern France were paid to record the music being broadcast by Allied stations and send the discs to Germany. There, the music was transcribed, and some of it given to a peculiar jazz orchestra that had been formed to play for German radio's English service. A compere and singer called Karl Schwedler, who was clearly high up in the Nazi Party, together with a well-paid group of jazz musicians, broadcast their versions of popular British and American hits twice a week.
Here is the latest song of the British airmen. Let's go bombing, oh, let's go bombing, just like good old British airmen do. Let us bomb the Frenchmen who were once our allies. England fights for liberty, we make them realize. From the skies, let's go shelling where they're dwelling. Shelling Nanette, Fifi and Lulu. Let us go to it, let's do it. Let's sink their food ships too. Let's go bombing, it's becoming quite the thing to do.
The programmes on Tuesday and Friday were introduced as Charlie and His Orchestra. The few who did listen to it were treated to very sarcastic comments, which probably did more to put the Allies on the defensive than entertain them. Charlie had regular digs at the BBC too.
When you tune in London Way, every evening, every day, you will find some guy talking the wishful talk.
Aye.
Every little commentary with its little thud of glee, you'll hear them all talking a wishful talk.
Aye.
Everything BBC's, hear what your damn well pleases. Hear how the speakers lie there, cry there, die there. When you tune in London Way, every evening, every day, you'll find some guy talking a wishful talk.
Aye.
For Allied troops in North Africa, Berlin created a general overseas programme designed to be confused with the forces network of the BBC.
This is the German Overseas Service signing off its national programme.
We shall be back again tomorrow at the very same time. Until then, we're saying good night.
The relatively high-power commercial stations that had operated in Normandy and Luxembourg before the war were used by both sides. In early 1940, the former Radio Normandy, which had broadcast to England from France, was reopened for a while, ostensibly to broadcast to British troops in France, and also to broadcast some brief resistance messages to Austria and Czechoslovakia.
And now the International Broadcasting Company's transmission is drawing to a close. To those of you who are keeping watch on board the ships of the seven seas, fair winds and a good passage.
But with the fall of France to the Germans, Radio International, as it was called, was hastily switched off. Further to the northeast, the Nazis used Radio Luxembourg's high-power medium-wave transmitter to strengthen reception of Lord Haw-Haw in Britain. But as the Allies pushed towards Berlin, so it became obvious that Germany was losing. On William Joyce's last broadcast, he'd clearly drunk far too much.
And therefore I say to you, in these last words, you may not hear from me again for a few months. I say, Es lebe Deutschland, Heil Hitler, and farewell.
All right, thank you very much, Jonathan. That is the final part of Wartime Deception. Now, you can also catch the weekly 30-minute edition of this program right here on WRMI. To find out the times, the distribution is done through the World Radio Network, so you can find it on their website, wrn.org. Hope you enjoyed the program. We're not going to bring you propagation this week because Dan also needs a little bit of a break. But don't worry, we'll be back again very soon for more from the world of communications. Course, on the monthly and weekly edition of the program. So on behalf of everyone that helped put the program together, we're going to end today with a little bit of music with Karin Costa doing the Burt Bacharach classic, I Say a Little Prayer for You. So until next time, 73 and 88 to the ladies.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little
pray for you.
Ooh, while combing my hair now and wondering why.